Discipleship. We want to make more and better Catholics. It's not our mission to engage in investigative reporting. On the Church and Culture episode that was aired May 7th, Sister Rita Callanan and Margaret Holm were allowed to make claims about the Archbishop and Archdiocese of Los Angeles regarding the sale of certain property associated with the IHM Sisters. When we contacted the Archdiocese for a response, the Archdiocese informed us that at least five statements made during that program were false and injurious to the reputation of the Archbishop and the Archdiocese. We deeply regret these statements were ever made on our air. We disavow these statements made by these guests and the implicit agreement of our host. The radio program is not the venue to explore these kinds of charges and countercharges, which involve civil law. The civil courts have taken up this question, and they've judged in favor of the Archdiocese. Ave Maria Radio has no reason to conclude that the Archdiocese or Archbishop have not acted in good faith with regard to the sisters and the property. And we deeply regret the entire incident.
My guest today has been on once before, and for a similar reason. Eric Butler has translated yet another book of Léon Boise into English for us, for our enjoyment, and for our, enlightenment. This particular book is his second book of short stories, translated by Eric Butler, and this one's entitled Sweating Blood. The other book of short story, Disagreeable Tales, published really only a few months ago, also by Wakefield. That book of short stories was published in 1893, and this one, Sweating Blood, in 1894, Eric has 17 books either written or translated presently on what's called Goodreads. He's written three books of cultural history, two on vampires and one on the Bellum Grammaticale and the Rise of European Literature, and many other very interesting translations. Eric, welcome back to Church and Culture.
Thanks for having me.
Now, I have this question. After reading this second book of short stories that you have translated for us, I keep thinking that Léon Boise is what would be called in the Catholic tradition a reader of souls. You think that's an appropriate comment?
I think so. In fact, there is one story in this most recent collection where he does just that. He imagines the souls of Bismarck and
yes,
the deposed emperor of France talking to each other.
He wasn't too fond of Bismarck, but we get ahead of ourselves. First, let's remind our listeners just who this Léon Boise is. I would imagine they know that he's a great French Catholic figure, of some sort of writer. He's really very hard to summarize. Would you give it a shot?
All right. Well, I'll see what I can do. I think, is somebody who grew up very much as a free thinker and found that it really came too easily, and he was left empty-handed. So he turned and sought to penetrate what might be behind all of the easy sort of blasphemy and hypocrisy that one might indict, and try to discern the sort of spiritual architecture of the universe. So he used his old kind of iconoclastic tricks, as it were, but now to affirm the Catholic faith, as opposed to...
Well, he was very much opposed to the Catholic faith as a boy or young man.
Yeah, and he really, you can almost see the muscles twitching in a sort of spiritual conversion process in some of his stories, it seems, because it's really one sort of abiding focus of his works, I think, is people in moments of trial, where in particular their faith is tested, or else they have something like an epiphany and turn around. I mean, this doesn't always end well, mind you.
No.
But there's this autobiographical component, I think, in everything he writes, even when, you know, it's about somebody else altogether.
So he has these two books of short stories. He has two novels. I'm going to ask you about those in a little while. He has a number of important essays, perhaps the most important one being on the Jews. Perhaps we can get into that. Very influential. And then he has, 84 volumes of diaries?
I certainly have not read everything that he has written, but his diaries are really vast, and both on sort of horizontal and vertical axes. I mean, of course, everything he writes goes pretty deep too.
I think the one book that is known perhaps by some of our listeners is one that was translated some years ago, entitled Pilgrim of the Absolute, and that evidently was taken from his diaries of 1914. And that has, in fact, the name Pilgrim of the Absolute is really kind of stuck with Bois.
Yeah, absolutely.
absolutely. And he was, of course, in very important in the lives of Jacques-Henri Samartin and their conversion, she from Judaism, he from a kind of liberal Protestantism that they both grew up in. And they famously wrote about him, at length in two of her memoirs, and he, from time to time, would tell stories. Here's one he tells. He said in 1959, he said he was at a cafe with a friend of his with Bois, and they were with another poet, and a passerby accosted the poet saying, "Hello, my dear fellow, always a poet, a beauty lover, always climbing in the clouds." Whereas the poet said to Bois, "And you, my dear fellows, always going your way downwards." Meaning that he was always, always looking for the damned.
To his credit, I think, didn't make things very easy on anyone else, he didn't make it easy on himself either, by really taking very seriously the injunctions in the Bible. He was aware of all the perils in the world and just how close hell is to the earth's surface,
which come through abundantly in both books of short stories, but in particular this one is entitled, that you've just translated from Wakefield so beautifully, entitled Sweating Blood. The setting is the Franco-Prussian War for these 30 stories. Short stories can be read. Each can be read within a matter of 10 minutes. And, of course, you need to take a breather in between because each packs such amazing power. Tell our listeners a little bit about the setting of the Franco-Prussian War and why it was so important for Léon Bois.
Really is a pivotal moment in European history because it occurred in the 19th century, but it connects the 18th and the 20th in the aftermath of France's really surprisingly abrupt and humiliating defeat. Germany emerged as this, by many unanticipated power on the continent, and the enduring wounds France had to lick fed into, as well as the great success Germany had enjoyed, all of this fed into the conflicts, into the Great War in 1914. Nice. So, as a consequence of the Franco-Prussian War, France lost territories, adjacent to Germany, Alsace-Lorraine. And so that's...
This was less than a year. This was a very short war, as wars are.
Very brief. And also...
We're talking about 1870 to 1871, and evidently the Germans, whom Wall calls the Prussians, just completely annihilated the French. Why was that?
Yeah. Well, France was a little bit too foolhardy and self-assured for one thing. And moreover, even though Blois always defers to authority, you do get a picture of the government that is not at all favorable. So Napoleon III, who was really a very pale version of his more illustrious forebear, who, of course, had no problem marching all over Germany, and the rest of Europe, half a century before, Napoleon III wasn't nearly as able a military commander. So the Prussian ability to mobilize troops and, of course, deploy discipline, for which they have since become famous, really caught the French, who were rather a bit too self-assured, off guard. And
well, this really foreshadows not only World War I, but World War II.
Oh, absolutely. It certainly does. I mean, that's why, some historians even speak of, World War I and World War II as the 20th century's 30 years war. That is to say, it makes more sense when viewed together, because matters simply weren't resolved after the first round of combat.
Well, they were actually worsened by the Treaty of Versailles. But, you have in these 30 short stories, really, maybe 15 of them, a dozen of them are stories of atrocity, which, of course, is foreshadowing. And you have one that has a little bit of, I guess, a happy ending, if you want to call it, a French peasant who refused to sell his firewood to his own French comrades who were freezing, the soldiers outside, is come upon by Prussian troops who take over and completely, they rape his wife multiple times and burn his wood and destroy his house. And then a few days later, he burns to death 80 Prussian soldiers who have come to spend another night at his house. So you have this kind of back and forth.
If ever there was a happy ending.
Not said of sorts. In every case, with Blois's telling of atrocity, he almost tells it as if he's not surprised by it.
That's certainly true. I think he took, far more seriously than most, the dogma of original sin, or the doctrine of original sin, which is that all mortal beings are created and therefore imperfect and prone to error, and this multiplies exponentially, as it were, the more human beings you put together.
Yes.
So it's only natural, as it were, that if the first two brothers couldn't get along, Cain and Abel, who incidentally have their counterparts in other traditions, you know, Romulus and Remus, and that ends in bloodshed, the Theocles and Polynices and the Greek tradition and so forth. But if already, you know, just the first human family has troubles, then...
Cain and Abel.
Yeah, this will be just much more worse when, you know, you're talking about things on a national scale.
So here you have a...
National one.
Here you have a writer who was born in 1846, by the way, the same year as the Marian visions at La Salette, which he was a great fan of, and he was justly jealous of the attention shown to the Lourdes visions, which took place 1858, 12 years later. But he grows up with an intense hatred for the church. He has an encounter with a famous French author, and I'm not going to try to pronounce his name, even though I admire him, Barbet.
Oh, D'Urville, yes, absolutely.
D'Urville,
who also makes a cameo in these stories.
Yes, and who helps him the way he helped the Maritains undergo conversion, and then he becomes what's called the ungrateful beggar, because he doesn't care about money. And so he's constantly writing, I guess, begging letters. Have you ever read any of these?
Oh,
friends for money?
Letters?
Yeah.
Yes, he, you know, doesn't, he's definitely not a courtier, not a very fawning personality.
Right. By the way, I made a mistake earlier. It's 8 volumes of diaries. I don't know where I thought I got the double digits, but 8 volumes.
That's one of the wonders of Blois. He kind of is this prism that just kind of, you know, makes everything assume.
Thank you. He becomes this controversial isn't enough. I mean, he's actually hated by a lot of the elite, but he's also held very dear and is still held very dear by many of the literary and intellectual elites that you wouldn't imagine. Borges, for example.
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. Absolutely.
Borges is an example.
Mm-hmm. Well, he's certainly, I don't think that anyone, you know, who knows a thing about literature, and there's hardly anyone more bookish than Borges, but I don't think anyone else who really understands the art of writing could fail to acknowledge his command of language. It's much easier to see how somebody might not particularly like what he says with it, but there's this incredible virtuosity, the way that he can really pack just an incredible amount of force into a few short words. I mean, it's remarkable just how short most of these stories are, but how...
And short sentences, too, for that matter.
Yeah.
And by the way, I mean, you're, as the translator and fluent in French, you're in a position to speak to the issue of his command of writing in French. As a reader, I can only address his command of storytelling, narration, insight into character, the human condition. And that's, of course, what I think to anybody reading in translation is going to see him as a giant in that respect.
Yeah, well, he really, you know, if there were sort of a spiritual and literary equivalent of caricature, he does that. He gets the defining trait of someone.
Yes.
And that becomes really the orbit for everything else, because it's in light of this defining trait that they then respond to the situation he places them in. And so really it's like a series of sort of dilated moments, you know, just a brief period in time that is explored in all of its facets and in which the whole essence of someone, good or bad, more often bad than good, but occasionally good, comes out.
Or just Quixote. Quixote-like, I'm thinking of the last story in the collection, The Siege of Rhodes, the character of the Viscount, which is, I would call that Quixote-ish rather than good or bad. Do you think that's fair?
I think so. It is, and one of the funniest things about him, funny really in both ways in this case, because there is humor, even if it's very dark. But one of the funniest things about Law is how much affection he has for many of these improbable people that he portrays. I mean, in this case, this crazy old aristocrat who's so committed to a sort of superannuated vision of the world that he basically thinks he's still in the Middle Ages. And
all he can do is brood upon his Knight of Malta forebears, and live in a 100-year-old ruined chateau, and go to the local church, which is, I guess, in some way representative or has his ancestors buried there, and or at least members of the Knights of Malta, and. But he talks about this strange respect that this Viscount gets from the townspeople, even though he's obviously the local crazy.
Yeah. Now, that is... I'm sorry, I didn't interrupt.
No, I meant for you to explain why. Why does he get that respect?
Well, and interestingly enough, I mean, to a certain extent, he even gets it from the from some of the German invaders. That's because Blois appreciates, I think, the very odd kinds of balance that can be struck between people when there is an overarching set of beliefs and culture that sort of helps them to navigate the world. So on the one hand, the peasants are very happy to basically cheat the Viscount, but on the just in commercial terms. But on the other hand, they have an immense amount of respect for him because he so fully embodies what he stands for. So I mean that's.
Right. It's the other story that this reminded me of was the third story, the good gendarme, who similarly, you know, he, even though he's retired and he was this very punctilious, disciplined policeman, who when he retires loses all of his status completely and lives, he sort of falls into all kinds of, you know, disorder, personal disorder, and abuse, but then the Prussians come marching in, and he feels the call to arms. Tell our listeners what he does.
Yeah, well, no, his life gets meaning again. So he takes out his old uniform and presses it and polishes the boots and shines up his regalia and weapons and starts marching, you know, for hours or days or however long it takes him until he can finally see this enemy he's heard about. And just as if, you know, he still were running the show and in a position of authority, he tells, you know, the first group of people that he comes upon that he wants to see their papers. And it turns out, you know,
and luckily for him, the Prussian general who's in charge doesn't let his soldiers shoot him. He gets it. Right. He sees this guy for what he is.
Yeah. So there is this kind of it's comic and sad too. But there are these occasional flashes of the harmony that is that maybe is gone now, but once existed, that still provides a point of, the only point of orientation, really, for all these lost souls.
And this is one of the few times in the book that a Prussian comes across as a human being.
Yes. Although there are other instances, there's a very grim story, you might recall, called Useless Ghosts, which is about this young seminarian who, full of patriotic zeal, volunteers to defend France and Christendom, and he's just completely overwhelmed by all the pointless marching and losing campaigns. And there's just a flash of it, but at one point, he's in this very enervated state and about to collapse, but he sees a bunch of the enemy, and he just goes charging after them, although, you know, in fact, I mean, there's no way that somebody so young and sick and tired could do anything. And what Blois says is something to the effect of, and then this, you know, big German bear, who was just a mass of red hair, just grabbed the boy, lifted him up, sat him on his lap, and shoved a bottle of brandy in his mouth. Just like a baby.
We're going to take a short break now, and we'll be back talking more with Eric Butler, the translator, and now exegete, because I've got him on the show, of Léon Blois' second set of short stories. He just translated for Wakefield, entitled Sweating Blood. We'll be right back after this short break.
It's time for Family Man with Dr. Gregory Popchuk.
You've heard it said that children are resilient, but it turns out that's not as true as we might like to think. A study in the journal Clinical Neuroimaging reports that children who experienced common family stressors like a lack of affection, marital problems, or poor communication experienced less development in the brain regions responsible for impulse control and stress regulation than did children who were raised in homes without similar stressors. The study is a wake-up call for moms and dads to attend to marriage and parenting struggles promptly. Currently, many couples wait 4 to 6 years before getting professional help. Knowing the effect that marriage and family stress has on our children's developing brains can hopefully encourage parents to get help sooner rather than later. To encourage good impulse control and stress management in our kids, the most important parenting technique is providing our children with a loving, affectionate, peaceful home life. I'm Dr. Greg Popchuk, but you can call me Family Man.
To discover more ways faith can enrich your life, visit CatholicCounselors.com.
Why should we do no work on the Sabbath as the third commandment demands? The Catholic Catechism reminds us that in 6 days the Lord God made the heavens and the earth and the seas and all that is in them. On the seventh day he rested, thereby blessing and hallowing the Sabbath. The Sabbath is also a memorial of Israel's liberation from Egypt. The Sabbath is a sign of God's irrevocable covenant with Israel. Thus, the day is to be set apart as holy and for the praise of God, his work of creation, and his saving action on behalf of Israel. God set a model for human action. If the Almighty Creator could take a day off for rest and refreshment, so should his creatures. For Christians, Sunday replaces Sabbath observance because it is the day Jesus rose from the dead and ushered in the new creation. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
I'm back with Eric Butler, who's translated his second book of the Catholic writer Léon Blois, and in doing so has probably doubled the number of Blois volumes in translation. The two books he's translated, Disagreeable Tales and now Sweating Blood, both from Wakefield. And please support Eric and Blois and Wakefield and your own mind by purchasing these books. I know you'll love them. He wrote two novels, and these novels followed these short stories fairly closely. The one that has been translated, The Woman Who Was Poor, which Cardinal O'Connor told me was his favorite book. and asked me to hand over my translation to him because he said he first read it in French but didn't want to go back and do it again after so many years. He wanted to read English. But his first novel from 1887, The Woman Who Was Poor came 10 years later. The first novel from 1887, which would have been 4 years after Sweating Blood, never been translated, but isn't it considered one of his greatest works?
I actually need to look more into the vicissitudes of Blois reception.
It's English. In English translation, the name is Despairing.
Yeah.
The French, is what, Le Desperé?
Le Desperé. And it's very it's really unvarnished. Very much in the first person, and it's got this kind of directness that, yeah, it's his own story.
Well, you know, Eric, I hate to be like this, but since you've done the two short stories and the next major work is this novel from 1887, it would make perfect sense, to me anyway, that you would dive in and start translating it.
I just may do that. I actually, it's been some time since I've read it, but I do, of course, as is invariably the case with anything one reads by Blois, there are just some images that never leave you. And he describes his female companions. I can't remember if she's his wife at this point or not, but basically her process of self-mortification that is as gruesome as anything you would read in, one of these medieval accounts.
Or the French decadence.
Yeah, absolutely. But the difference is that here, it doesn't have that kind of aestheticizing veneer that one gets so often. This account how she shaves off all of her head and has her teeth pulled.
Oh no!
Because her beauty is a curse.
Oh no!
It ties to this world. It's really, yeah. So anyway, I may translate it, but boy, it's tough stuff, especially considering. Again, everyone, I suppose, is inclined to embellish their life, but Blois, if anything, is, I don't know what the opposite would be, but, he makes it even uglier.
I think you'd have a hit on your hands, and let me tell you why. I spent the morning, with great pleasure, going through as much of the Blois material I could find on the Internet, and I've got a lot in my bookcase, but I'm familiar with it, so I went out. And everyone refers to this novel as a high point. I think you'd have a hit on your hands. So would Wakefield.
Okay. Well, I do plan.
And we'll help you here on this show and on this radio network to help you sell it.
All right. Well, I'll get in touch with Mark.
That's a promise.
I think he's a great writer, and I want to translate more by him. And what's more, I know that the books have been very well received, and they're certainly not. It's not a money losing proposition. It's
good. I'm so glad to hear that because we want more. And I want to tell our listeners, you have an introduction. You wrote an introduction to both of these books of short stories. Your writing itself is a marvel. I'm not trying to embarrass you or flatter you. It just is. And as I read it, I thought that you were channeling Blois. It was so edgy and really insightful, beautifully written. And I want to see if I can read to you. Oh, yeah, I'll read this paragraph to you. With willful anachronism, Blois affirmed the superiority of spiritual truth. especially when it shocks and confounds human reason. He stood to the right of the right, as it were. From this eccentric position, he wanted nothing so much as to leave behind terrestrial engagements. And so, standing on the cruelly insipid plains of mortal existence, surrounded by his benighted contemporaries fumbling in the dark, Bois shifted his view along a vertical axis. At this angle, fleeting human events offered a reflection of enduring patterns in heaven above and hell below, where nothing changes because it was all written by divine hand before time began. That's really good. Really good, Eric.
Well, you know, reading Bois is what does that, you know? I mean, he's a master stylist, and as any writer will tell you, you know, read people who write well, and that will certainly help you.
It rubs off. To sort of probe at another theme of these particular short stories that are, again, the context being the Franco-Prussian War, I get the impression that none of the French soldiers really wanted to be fighting, or they didn't know why they were fighting. And they were completely mistreated and abused by their generals. It was, in other words, you had an entire generation of French men thrown out into the field, a very harsh winter, and they were always going from place to place, seemingly irrationally, and without order, and sort of just fending for themselves. So, I mean, what is Bois trying to relate? What kind of impact did that have on this generation of Frenchmen?
Well, that's a good question, and it's also one that can be asked, about just about any military engagement. I certainly know, you know, closer to our own day, that there are people who, on the one hand, you know, felt that they were doing the right thing in performing the patriotic duty by going to war, but were completely, you know, dumbfounded by the decisions made by parties higher up and so forth.
Right.
And so that's a common experience. One thing that is certainly a historical fact is that, you know, Napoleon III, again, who, you know, wanted this conflict because he thought it would be easy, wasn't enjoying the best of rules. I mean, he wasn't altogether successful or popular domestically, and needless to say, when things went as badly as they did in this conflict, you know, he wound up no longer being the ruler of France, and you know, Republican government was instituted again. But throughout this whole period, in French history, but then also European history, the Franco-Prussian War is a real turning point because, you know, there were domestic problems in France, and actually in the wake of the war, Paris briefly stood under popular rule. That is, the so-called Paris Commune was instituted, which was
that didn't last long.
It didn't, but the reason it didn't is because the new Republican government went in and killed all the radicals.
It was a complete slaughter.
It was a complete slaughter. So Bois, although he's got these very conservative sensibilities, he actually has an enormous amount of sympathy for the vanquished in general, people who were trying to, preserve French culture after this horrible experience with the Germans, who just wound up getting slaughtered en masse by their countrymen in the name of, a virtuous Republican government. So So the irony there didn't escape him at all. So that's one of the sort of backdrops historically for all of this. And then, of course, as we discussed at the beginning of the show, this was the rise of Germany, specifically Prussia.
Militarism.
Yeah. And so Germany was politically unified, actually, during this conflict, because one way, of course, now as then, to bring people together is to get...
There was no unified Germany before this war. Yes.
And so that's another reason, that, of course, that Blois hates Bismarck, because... And it's also another aspect of, you know, his farsightedness historically, because he sort of saw what this would mean, not just in terms of, you know, the misfortunes of France in his own day, but what it would mean for Europe as a whole in the coming decades.
Given that, Eric, it's kind of really surprising that two of Blois' greatest admirers, one would be the most famous German writer to come out of World War I, and that's Ernst Jünger. Our readers may know him from his book Storm of Steel. And then I guess he was a Nazi, Carl Schmitt, the political philosopher of the Third Reich, who has won some respectability in his, you know, in the years after he died. So he had German admirers.
It's really remarkable. I think that's the point of departure for my introduction, as you know. Blois basically never says anything about German that doesn't have the word pig or even...
Right. And worse.
And yet these two German nationalists really admired his writings and therefore, I suppose, him too. And it is very interesting because what they recognized was just how big a perspective he had. He had, in effect, seen a lot of the things coming that they then faced during their lifetimes, and they might have stood on the other side, but as two very conservative people, they always respected rank, as it were. So they saw someone whose stature just demanded acknowledgement.
Now, there's a side of Blois that even I find hard to take. For example, his notes on the sinking of the Titanic and his notes, similar notes on the fire that burned down the famous Opéra Comique in Paris, seem to take delight in these tragedies.
Yes.
yes. What's going on there?
Well, the any kind of analogy is precisely that, you know, it's like one thing is like another, it's not the same, but occasionally one hears similar sentiments expressed today when there's some big misfortune, because again, to a certain kind of mindset, especially a religious one, it's evidence of God's justice. So basically, this is a punishment for human hubris, just overstepping the appointed bounds. Occasionally...
The Titanic would have been a kind of a perfect example of that.
Absolutely. It's just like the Twin Towers in New York, I mean, could be understood as, you know, a kind of Babylonian act of immoderation.
Yeah, if he had been alive, he might have seen it that way and become very, very unpopular in a hurry.
In fact, I would bet, Well, you know, it would, of course, take a parallel universe, but he certainly would have, because, you know, World Trade Center, I mean, that's a temple to money in his eyes,
right.
I'm sure.
Right. He was called a monster. He lived in complete poverty. He was a beggar. He was true to his own convictions in that he did not. He lived like a kind of a lay Franciscan or something, a complete beggar. Always, and evidently, when the Maritans went over to his apartment at his invitation, they couldn't believe the poverty he lived in. Couldn't believe it.
Yeah.
Do you think is it fair even to ask about a guy like Leon Bois whether he went too far? Because he seems to exist beyond those kinds of questions almost.
I think that's just in general, but certainly for him, that's also part of the appeal or it's not the appeal, it's something far more than that, but that's the power of literature. I mean, in this hypothetical space, you really can confront things and work through them that, if you didn't have this this outlet, might express themselves differently. And in other words, you can be as sociopathic or as visionary and deluded as you want to be when you're writing. And so it's actually a healthy thing in relative terms.
Did it come as a shock to you when Pope Francis, in his very first speech, quoted Bois?
Well,
his very first homily?
I was actually pretty thrilled I certainly am in no position to judge anyone, and especially the Pope. But I was really impressed that he referred to Bois, because even if Bois was certainly not the kindliest individual, it seems, he really, again, had this penetrating vision and saw what was at stake in religion and actually in lived Christianity. So not just, you know, smells and bells and pious sayings, but actually a undertaking an earthly journey that really, you know, hangs suspended between the heavens and hell, and sort of realizing that just seeing things in this huge cosmic perspective. So I really thought that it was great when he referred to him, because also Bois took all of these injunctions to help the poor and so on and so forth very, very seriously. Even if he probably isn't the kind of guy you would want to have helping you too much. I don't know, that might be an incentive to really
just think what you'd have to put up with to get his help. you have a short story here which I want to make sure we mention. We have about 5 minutes left, Eric, called The Obstacle. And you have this setting that I've already mentioned of French soldiers in this long line, not knowing where they're going, heading out again, and there's this, they go into this town, they're headed into this town, and they don't know why they're moving so slowly, and it's at a standstill. And in the very last paragraph, well, the sentence before the last paragraph is, "Then with my own eyes did I behold the unknown obstacle," and you have that in capital letters. And what we see here is a cart, and it's lighted by a torch, and it's occupied by a kneeling woman and a corpse. Her hair undone, the woman, mad with grief, is bemoaning, I guess it's the death of her husband. And this last paragraph, let me read it aloud and then explain to me why I find this so moving. And in a way, it really sticks out in this collection of stories. Her hair undone, the woman mad with grief struck us as France herself. She bellowed cries so supernatural the horses reared up, whinnying in fear. Gingerly we proud sons beating the retreat, filed by hair on end, entrails in a knot and hearts pounding at the funeral service for the nameless dead, whom the lamentation of a mother or beloved now made as great as Charlemagne.
Okay, well, all right, so I should try to account for the effect that produces, which, yeah, well, I guess that's it. You know, I think it has a sort of almost, it seems to me, objective quality that just commands recognition, because what he's doing is painting a scene and sort of tying together in a very small space just a huge confluence of forces, because you don't know who the woman is. She could be a mother, she could be a wife, she could be a girlfriend or a sister. You don't know who the man is. It could be a father, it could be a son. So there's this immense charge, but it's left open-ended. And on the one hand, it evokes something eternal, like the Pietà, you know, which is Mary.
Yes.
And but on the other hand, it might just so it's as if the eternal, as it were, the symbol, sort of in capital with a capital S, shines through into the temporal world. Here, even if in fact this is just so and so with so and so, and nobody even knows their names, you can see here the sort of hieroglyphic, symbolic, metaphysical writing through the figures, as it were. And that's one aspect. And
why is she called the obstacle with a capital O? Yeah, I mean, she's the obstacle to the men marching through the town. But obviously with a capital O, she's more than that.
Well, it's also because it's the stumbling block, as it were, when you're sure of your gate, and then all of a sudden everything changes. There's this reversal of perspective, and that's another aspect of it too, because it's the kind of tension between the male world of soldiers, which is acting in a very unmanly fashion by fleeing, and then this feminine world of weakness and mourning, which in fact is very strong.
Yes.
So
yes,
it
humbles them.
Yeah, it's that switch. And again, it's like this nameless man who's dead there, you know, for this moment is greater than Charlemagne, who, of course, is this, you know, legendary ruler. So it's,
you know, creator of the Holy Roman Empire.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's all of these things. It's this abrupt switch of perspective that I think is so powerful here and elsewhere too. I mean, because that's what he does. He really has these supercharged little miniatures that then wind up being a complete fresco or like a wall of stained glass.
Which is again why Ball's a great writer. And we've come to the end of our time, Eric. I want to thank you, Eric Butler, for bringing out Léon Blois' second book of short stories. In addition to the first, Disagreeable Tales, we now have Sweating Blood, both from Wakefield Press. I really urge my listeners to give them a try, both of them. And, Eric, we want to thank you for doing this, and we really hope you'll be back on the show soon.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, we won't wait for you to translate the other novel by Blois. We'll have you back for other reasons. But thank you very much for being a guest on Church and Culture.
Oh, thank you. It's my pleasure.
And we'll be taking a short break before we have another wonderful guest.
Today's programming on 990 WDEO is made possible in part by a gift made from our day sponsor, in loving memory of Antony and Pirania Safransky, from their son Joseph, who thanks them for the gift of life and the gift of his Ukrainian Catholic faith. Today would have been their 89th wedding anniversary. May God be praised for Antony and Pirania.
Are you tired of the way your faith is represented in the mainstream media? Stop getting your Catholic news from secular sources and get it from a trusted local Catholic source instead. At the Michigan Catholic Newspaper, we're Catholic, and we cover your Catholic Church in a way that only Catholics could. For the same reason you listen to Ave Maria, get the Michigan Catholic for just $24 a year by calling 313-224-8000 or visit themichigancatholic.com.
This is Lavinia Spirito for Catholic Way Bible Study. In Acts 1:8, Jesus tells the disciples to go back to Jerusalem. You will receive power when the Holy Spirit comes on you, and you will be my witnesses in Jerusalem. The word translated as power is also the root for our word for dynamite. Jesus is promising an explosive power that will enable us to witness to the nations and live a powerful Christian life. That same powerful Holy Spirit is received in baptism and confirmation. As baptized and confirmed Catholics, we already have all we need to live life through the power of the Holy Spirit. If we remove the obstacles of our own understanding and lack of preparation and move with the Holy Spirit into the mission He has given us, we will change the world.
Catholic Way Bible Study. Peace, power, purpose. Find out more at cwbs.org.
Men, women, marriage. What's the point? Join Father John Ricardo as he walks us through God's plan for a marriage, Ephesians 5, fatherhood, and the dignity of woman. Learn why there are two creation stories. What does it mean to be children of God? And what does Paul mean when he says, wives, be subject to your husbands? All this and more is covered in Father John Ricardo's 4-CD set, What's the Point? To purchase your copy, go to AveMariaRadio.net and click on What's the Point under the Store tab.
Have you ever gotten so caught up in homeschooling your kids that everything else in your life just fell by the wayside? Well, it doesn't have to be that way. Today on Homeschool Heartbeat, our guest Pamela Price explains why self-care is so important for homeschooling parents.
Pamela, what are the biggest challenges of homeschooling and working at the same time?
Well, obviously the challenges are going to vary pretty widely by household and also by the line of work that the parent is trained in. But the challenge that I see come up the most is handling daycare for those situations when a parent has to have backup. And obviously single parents, that's going to be their biggest challenge. But the more flexible a family's schedules can become, the better. And one of the other challenges is a lot of times parents think that they have to work a traditional 8-to-5 school day. And anybody that's been homeschooling for a while will tell you, even if they choose to do it, everybody does it a little differently.
Well, Pamela, what are the characteristics of a successful working homeschool parent that you've seen?
You know, they're very inquisitive, they're curious, they're always